You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org Medscape Cardiology. And this is This Week in Cardiology for February 16th, 2018. This week, ICD use in patients with kidney disease, PFO and perioperative stroke, left ventricular assist devices, guideline-directed medical therapy after revascularization procedures, and a preview of some trials in 2018. First up, ICD in patients with chronic kidney disease. We know multiple RCTs have shown ICDs reduce mortality in patients with heart failure, but patients with severe kidney disease were excluded from these trials, and few patients in the trials had even moderate chronic kidney disease. We also know a meta-analysis of the three big ICD trials found a heterogeneous treatment effect for ICD therapy. Namely, they found no mortality benefit for the ICD in patients with a GFR less than 60. Now, with that as background, a group from Seattle and California and Colorado published a large, non-randomized comparison of ICD use in patients with chronic kidney disease. They published in JAMA Internal Medicine. This was a large cohort study of about 5,800 patients from the Kaiser Permanente Clinic. These patients had heart failure and chronic kidney disease as defined by a GFR less than 60. Now, this was a non-randomized comparison of patients with and without chronic kidney disease who received an ICD. And the researchers used a matching protocol that required the identification of approximately 500 variables from different data dimensions. So this was pretty extensive matching. They found no differences in mortality, but ICD patients with chronic kidney disease had higher rates of subsequent hospital admission and heart failure admission. Now, in the absence of an RCT, looking at ICD use in patients with chronic kidney disease, this is as good evidence as we're going to get. Yes, it is non-randomized, but the lack of benefit here is consistent with previous studies, at least ones that I can find. Now, the fact that ICDs do not improve outcomes in patients with chronic kidney disease makes perfect sense. Patients with kidney disease have significant competing causes of death. That is, sudden death due to VF is only one of the many ways a patient with chronic kidney disease can die, and that is important because ICDs only protect against sudden arrhythmic death. Also, it's pretty well established that patients with chronic kidney disease have greater rates of complications from the ICD. So I think the clinical implications of this work are huge. Remember, the biggest risk from an ICD, in my opinion, is that it can change one's mode of death from sudden and likely peaceful to one that is drawn out and filled up with suffering and loss of independence. When we implant ICDs in patients with lots of illnesses, this complication is more likely. I see this happen all too often. We have frail, elderly, patients with kidney disease. They meet ICD eligibility on paper, low ejection fraction, ischemic cardiomyopathy, so they get an ICD because they're eligible, but they have little chance of benefiting from the device because they have so many other comorbid conditions and other ways to die. Second topic, perioperative stroke and PFO. About 5% of all strokes occur in the perioperative period, and 5% may seem like a low number, but there are more than 800,000 strokes per year in the U.S. Researchers from the Mass General Hospital published a large observational study in JAMA looking at the risk of perioperative stroke and the presence of PFO. Now, this is a plausible relationship, right? Having a PFO might increase the risk of stroke after surgery because after surgery, there are pro-inflammatory, pro-thrombotic state. There are higher rates of venous thromboembolism. There's interruption of antithrombotic meds after surgery. So the research team studied about 150,000 patients who had non-cardiac surgery. They found PFO was present in about 1%. That's low, but of course, not all patients got echoes before surgery. Perioperative stroke occurred in 3.2% of those with a PFO and 0.5% in those without stroke. After adjustment, PFO associated with an increased risk of stroke by an odds ratio of 2.66. Now, the absolute risks were much lower. The PFO associated increased risk was 0.4%. But adding plausibility to the association was the finding that patients with PFO also had an increased risk of large vessel territory stroke. That would suggest that it was related possibly to a paradoxical embolism. This is interesting work, but the problem here are a few. First, we know PFO occurs in about 1 in 4 people, but in this study, only 1% of the population had known PFOs. That means we don't know what happened to the many other patients in this study who had PFOs. The other problem is that it's an observational study. The authors did a bunch of adjustments to account for the non-randomized groups, but still, unmeasured differences can bias the results. The editorialists make it clear that clinicians should not change practice based on this study. Rather, it should stir further investigation. And I agree with that statement strongly. It would be awful if we started doing echoes and bubble studies on people before surgery. Next topic is percutaneous assist devices. This week, the FDA expanded indications for the Impella ventricular assist pumps. The two new approved indications were: one was for high-risk PCI regardless of LV function, and the other was for cases of cardiogenic shock with causes other than MI or cardiac surgery. Previous approvals were for PCI that required LV dysfunction. This new FDA approval stimulated me to do some looking on the data to support these super expensive devices. I've used Impella during VT ablation, and I was shocked at the cost. So the first hit on PubMed was a health technology assessment by Health Quality Ontario. And this is a quote. They say, "On the basis of evidence, which is 18 studies, mostly observational, of low to very low quality, Impella 2.5 devices were associated with improved hemodynamic stability but had mortality rates and safety profiles similar to balloon pumps in high-risk PCI and cardiogenic shock. Our cost-effectiveness analysis indicated that Impella 2.5 is likely associated with greater cost and fewer quality-adjusted life years than balloon pump." I'll leave you that reference. Okay, so Impella looks to be no better than balloon pump. Well, the next question is, how good is balloon pump? Here, I found the Cochrane review for balloon pump for MI complicated by cardiogenic shock. And the conclusion of the authors, after looking at 7 eligible studies, was that balloon pump may have a beneficial effect on some hemodynamic parameters. However, this did not result in survival benefits, so there is no convincing randomized data to support the use of balloon pump in infarct-related cardiogenic shock. And I'll leave you that link as well. Maybe an interventionalist will comment and explain how we can afford to spend so much money on devices with limited value. Next topic, guideline-directed medical therapy in patients who've had revascularization and in clinical trials. The choice between coronary artery bypass surgery, CABG, and PCI for patients with multivessel CAD comes up often. Multiple trials have addressed this, and mostly long-term outcomes look better with coronary artery bypass surgery. One factor, though, that's not often talked about but was the focus of an interesting study published in JACC is compliance with GDMT. So an international group of authors, mostly surgeons, I think, did a systematic review and meta-analysis. They found 5 trials that fit the inclusion criteria, namely that they compared CABG and PCI and also reported compliance with medicines. The authors report 3 main findings. First, overall compliance was low. For instance, antiplatelet therapies, beta blockers, and statins was only 67% at 1 year and fell to 53% at 5 years. Now, compliance with GDMT was consistently lower for patients undergoing CABG compared with PCI. And compliance mattered when it came to clinical outcomes. As compliance with medical therapy increased in the PCI group relative to CABG, the better outcomes of CABG became less evident. There were no differences in clinical outcomes when compliance for PCI exceeded that of CABG by 8%. So I see 2 notable things to say here. One is that if compliance drops to this lower rate in the setting of a clinical trial, then we can expect it to be much lower in regular practice. And second, since more people came off medical therapy in the CABG arms, it's reasonable to think that this blunted CABG's long-term advantage in outcomes over PCI in most of these trials. In other words, CABG might have looked even more superior over the long term if people stayed on their meds in the CABG group. Finally, I want to highlight a feature that's up on the website. This is a podcast between Bob Harrington and Michael Gibson in which they review upcoming trials to look for in 2018. It is excellent. The first trial they talked about is Odyssey, which is a large outcomes trial with the other PCSK9 drug, alirocumab. There are important differences between Odyssey and Fourier, and I will discuss some of these in an ACC preview column that I'll do this weekend. Another big trial coming soon is the REDUCE-IT trial. Now, this is a RCT looking at high-dose fish oil supplements on top of a statin to treat patients with high triglycerides. There are also going to be numerous RCTs coming out in 2018 that look at dual antiplatelet therapy after PCI, which is important because this question comes up nearly every day. I was also impressed by the discussion surrounding AF ablation and the CABANA trial. CABANA is a randomized controlled trial, multicenter, that's supposed to be released this summer, and it's going to compare AF ablation versus medical therapy, and it's going to look at outcomes, not just AFib recurrences. Both of these leaders in cardiology advocated for a sham control trial for atrial fibrillation, and I completely agree with them. So that's it for this week in cardiology. I'm grateful that you listened. Thank you. This is John Mandrola from the Heart.org Medscape Cardiology.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from the Heart.org on Medscape.